Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and it is my honor and my privilege to be interviewing today Colonel Dan Marvin, U.S. Army Special Forces retired, an individual who has a number of interesting things to relate to us about some recent, although sadly overlooked or in some cases covered up, American history. Colonel Marvin, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you very kindly, Dave. It's a proud and pleasure.
Now, my audience is very familiar with much of the documentation concerning the assassination of President Kennedy, and indeed your career in the Special Forces is linked in a strange sort of way, in a number of different ways, with President Kennedy's assassination. In fact, you first volunteered for Green Beret duty on the day of his assassination.
That's right. I had read about his admiration of the Green Berets and how he had personally authorized the Green Beret itself for wear by the U.S. Army Special Forces. And the day he was died, I was out at Yuma Proving Ground in Arizona. I was a parachute test officer, and that day I decided, because I did admire him, to join the Green Berets.
Now,
and I did.
In the Green Beret, you began special warfare school, including training in assassination and terrorism. Could you fill us in on some of the details concerning that?
Well, I went through two different courses there at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, on a place we call Smoke Bomb Hill, which a neat name. One was a counterinsurgency and special warfare staff officer course in January, it started, and then a special forces officers course, and basically it's the qualification course for officers to wear the Green Beret. And towards the end of the training, they asked for volunteers for assassination training and terrorism training, which was conducted by the Central Intelligence Agency, and I was one of, I believe, was six volunteers for that.
Now, this would be January of 64.
That's correct.
Some of your instructors, then, in addition to military, were actually CIA.
That's correct. We had one other class on industrial sabotage that was taught by a man from the FBI.
I guess the point being here that this is an inter-jurisdictional operation, not just military, but other intelligence services involved as well. One of the things that you mentioned in an article that was published in the Fourth Decade, a periodical dealing with President Kennedy's assassination, was that some of your CIA instructors, as part of this specialized training, were showing footage from the Zapruder film.
Yes, well, I really don't honestly know if it was a Zapruder film, but it was the same events on camera, and perhaps just a little bit different. I don't think anything was cut out of it. It may have been the original Zapruder film, but they were very careful to document the entire thing as an example of the way to develop an assassination, a conspiracy on a leader of a country while fingering some one person as the assassin and hiding, covering up the conspiracy aspect of it.
Fascinating bit of information. We're going to get to that in just a second about how they, in a sense, were already, to those of you who were in this training, negating the official version of the assassination. One of the things that you mentioned was that another former Green Beret, a Captain John McCarthy, while working as a policeman in Miami, got wind of organized crime figures in the Miami area being recruited to kill President Kennedy.
Yeah, see, one of the other police officers on the force down there who had actually worked undercover with the mafia told John McCarthy personally that, and John McCarthy, by the way, was trained as I was at Fort Bragg, North Carolina in 1964, not in the same class I was in, but in assassination training. He told me that himself personally. And he also related to me how this other police officer told him that he had overheard the conversation between somebody from the company, and I do not know who, and one of the members of the mob down there who tried to recruit them to hit him when he was going to visit Miami. And it would have been, oddly enough, he would have been killed on the identical day that the No Brothers were assassinated in Vietnam on 1 November 1963. Would have been the day the hit would have taken place.
And, of course, that eliminated the government in Vietnam. This was at the very beginning of November of 63.
That is correct.
One of the things that you mentioned was that an individual who figures in Captain McCarthy's situation and who also figured in President Kennedy's autopsy at Bethesda Naval Hospital, that was a naval officer named Fink. Well, basically, he's an individual who is common to both Captain McCarthy's situation, whom you maintain was incorrectly or improperly framed for a crime.
Yes.
And, of course, Colonel Fink, or rather Commander Fink, I don't know what rank he held at the time, but in any case, a naval officer named Pierre Fink, who was one of the autopsy surgeons at President Kennedy's autopsy in Bethesda Naval Hospital, testified in Jim Garrison's court that he was ordered by unnamed superior officers not to dissect President Kennedy's neck wound, which is proof, legal proof, in unimpeached legal testimony in an American law court that there was a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get to the Bethesda Naval Hospital autopsy of President Kennedy because it's central to your story in a minute, but jumping back to the assassination training that you were getting at Fort Bragg.
Right.
You mentioned that some.
By the way, on Pierre Fink, he was also involved in some real shenanigans and obfuscation of the whole concept of what happened with John McCarthy and the general court martial, where he was set up to take the rap on an assassination of a double agent, and Pierre Fink was involved in that also to the extent of. Somehow, at the end, the result being that he was never retried for it because they would have had to release the CIA records of an operation that involved that John McCarthy was involved in, along with another man that I know from the CIA who doesn't want his name mentioned in a proposed. Assassination of Prince Sihanouk in 1967, a year after, as you know, I was involved.
We're going to get to the attempts to recruit you to kill Prince Norodom Sihanouk of Cambodia much later on in our interview.
Yeah.
It sounds to me like what was used vis-a-vis Captain McCarthy was what's known as the national security defense or the reverse national security defense. In other words, compromising a criminal investigation by claiming that the relevant records can't be released for national security purposes.
That's correct.
We should state just for formal legal purposes that no charges in connection with the McCarthy case were ever brought against Pierre Fink.
That's correct.
It may be that he was simply following the orders of superior officers, as he maintains was the case with regard to the Kennedy autopsy.
I would think that more likely than any other explanation.
Again,
he was operating under intimidation.
Yep. Right. Again, for formal legal purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned, and this is very fascinating to me, the CIA instructors, or some of them, who were showing footage, whether it was the Zapruder film or another film of Kennedy's assassination, were actually showing this as an example of assassination methodology in which a head of state could be successfully conspired against and then a lone nut or a patsy set up to take the fall. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Well, basically, they showed us with a layout of the whole Dealey Plaza and Dallas area, how it was set up. Well, there was a man on the rooftop of the book depository, the lower rooftop. It was one of the shooters, the man on the grassy knoll, and then there was two other shooters with spotters that were on alternate routes to the hospital, and the way that was supposed to work is the spotter was supposed to advise the shooter whether or not he thought that Kennedy could make it to the hospital in good enough condition to be brought back to life, and if he thought it was not, then he'd be hit again at that point on the route. And basically, they told us that, about all the different kinds of people that had to be involved in order to assure the success, and then in the meantime, a collateral cover-up operation developed to point the finger at somebody else, namely Oswald.
The central point being that here in your assassination instruction at Fort Bragg in 1964, you had intelligence community agency instructors admitting, and not only admitting, but it sounds as though they were holding this up as an example of how to do it right.
Well, they were, yeah, you know, although they didn't say we did it.
Right.
You know, but then again, during one of the coffee breaks, a friend of mine and I both overheard one of them just looking at the other and saying something to the effect, well, it went pretty well in Dallas, didn't it?
Huh. And again, this by way of underscoring what a great many military veterans at the time came to experience. A number of people who were in the military at that time heard from various other people in the military who hated Kennedy that, yeah, we got him, basically. You know, this was it. There are many people who were privy to off-the-record information of the type that you have related. Now,
well, one of the things was that the conventional military hierarchy, especially the man who Johnson appointed as chief of staff later on, Harold K. Johnson, hated the Green Berets. They just didn't like us at all.
Kennedy, we'll perhaps get to Kennedy's Vietnam policy and how it was altered by assassination later on this side. Now, another of your postings in the Green Beret was to Natick, Massachusetts. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, and also your encounter with some organized crime figures there who also apparently had a contract against Kennedy shopped around to them.
Yes, Master Sergeant Joe Hill and myself were personally selected by General William Yarborough, Commanding General of the Special Warfare Center, to go to Natick, Massachusetts. And this ran from November to January, off and on, November 1964 to January 65, to test Special Forces equipment, rucksacks, boots, things of that nature, and jumping, taking them from the laboratory there at Natick out to a civilian airport and jumping them in secret testing of that equipment. Not that it was any really secret equipment. And while we were there, we stayed at a motel where Frank Sinatra happened to be singing, and we knew somewhat from what we'd heard in our training of some of the tie-ins that at least they felt that he had with the Mafia. So we assumed we'd run into him, and we did. And to make a long story short, we ended up being wined and dined by the son of the local Don, and the last time we met the Don himself, and I took the opportunity at that time because I felt that the CIA was involved in the assassination, asked him if he had been contacted by the company, the CIA, and he said yes. He said he'd been called about a hit in Boston, but I told him I was not interested. He said, and I can quote this, we don't have any trouble with the Kennedys in Massachusetts. And basically that's what he said. And he offered us a job as a hit team, and we refused it. We had to get back to our military post, of course, and we swore on a blood oath that we wouldn't reveal each other's names, and I assume they haven't and we haven't.
Okay, fine, and certainly not something I want to attempt to interfere with in any way. The point being that when you were posted to Natick Laboratories, you had corroborating information from an organized crime element up there that dovetails with what Captain McCarthy had learned when he was working as a Miami policeman, namely that members of the intelligence community, CIA or whoever, were shopping around a contract to organized crime elements on President Kennedy.
John McCarthy has reported this to the ARRB and the AARC, where Jim Lazar is, and I've reported mine, and neither one of them have indicated any interest whatsoever.
Now, there certainly were organized crime elements that figured in President Kennedy's assassination,
well,
but at the same time, those people, such as the House Select Committee, who attempted to pin it just on organized crime, I think, are whistling Dixie, because the organized crime does not control the Pentagon and the news media.
That's right.
And the national security establishment. Now, sticking with President Kennedy's assassination, you were later contacted, along with a Captain Vanek, that's spelled, by the way, for members of the audience, V-A-N-E-K, by a member of the intelligence community, CIA or somebody else, who attempted to get you to kill what was represented to you as a traitor. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. Colonel C.W. Patton, who's now retired and lives in Florida, who was the commanding officer of the 6th Special Forces Group to which I was assigned, called me into his office and told me there's a company man waiting under the trees to talk to me. So I went out there, and Captain Vanek was there, too, and Captain Vanek and I had gone through training together, and I introduced myself to the company man. He showed me his ID, and then immediately put away, and I immediately forgot his name. And he asked me if I would volunteer, because all these things are volunteer, to assassinate a Navy officer who was terminate him, and that he was about to give secrets to the enemy. I accepted it initially, thinking that it would be overseas, because I was on orders at the time to go to Vietnam, and it's very simple when you get to a place that Air America or Southern Air Transport, some CIA proprietary airplane can pick you up and take you wherever has to be done, and then you do your business and go back, and nobody knows that you've been gone even. In the States, it's different. They have to drop you as a deserter, and then your family knows and everything else. So I assumed it was overseas, and then he told me it was to be done at Bethesda Naval Hospital, and I told him no, I wouldn't do it. I had already asked him for the name of the man before I refused it, and he gave it to me. But then when I refused it, it was based on the fact that it was to be in the continental United States, which I never volunteered to do anything here. And I think he assumed that I'd never tell anybody. I assumed that he'd never say anything about it, and I assumed that he was, in fact, a traitor and that somebody would take care of him.
And that naval officer's name was?
William Bruce Pitzer.
And that's spelled P-I-T-Z-E-R. Again, some members of the audience might be taking notes.
Right. And then when I refused it, then he walked on over, and I was kind of dismissed, and I went back to my work, and he went over and talked to Captain Vanek. Now, that's David H. Vanek. Now, I don't know what he talked to him about, but I do know this, that I never saw Vanek from that day on. He disappeared. And I have been completely unable to contact him, even trying through the Department of the Army Veterans Services Directorate. I even sent him copies of the order showing that Vanek and I were both assigned to the school, taking that training. Not that it mentioned specifically assassination training. And what I got back from them was that they'd been unable to identify a record of service for the person concerned. I went to Congressman Hinchey. And he got his man, Jim Tastani from Ithaca, supposedly contacted the Veterans Services Directorate, and they told him that there is no such a person as David H. Vanek ever existed in the Army, even though we had the orders and everything else on it.
So, in other words, this...
Now Congressman Hinchey refuses to go any farther on it.
So, in other words, this Captain Vanek appears to have become a non-person.
Yes.
And this directory, why don't you explain to members of the audience what that is and where it's located? Because, again, many of them would not necessarily know what we're talking about.
The Veterans Service Directorate, located in St. Louis, Missouri. And interestingly enough, the latest retired service bulletin I got says they're about to discontinue the service. And what you do, you want to locate somebody, you write a letter to them, you put the letter in an envelope and put his name and rank and serial number on it as you knew it last, and send it to them, and they mail it to the person. I've been very successful. That's how I located Colonel Patton through that same service, and some of the men on my team that were on my A-team in Vietnam. But in this case, they came back and said that they could not identify a record of service for that person.
And now the congressional representatives who have been assisting you have, shall we say, given up the chase.
They're not only that, but they're stonewalling me on it. In fact, I wanted some military records on William Bruce Pitzer himself, so I could determine, you know, just exactly what he was being reported as being at the time that I was asked to kill him. And Congressman Hinchey came back in writing the one time that he did write me, saying that those records could not be available, maybe not even to the widow. In the meantime, I wrote under the Freedom of Information Act, and I got them.
Now, the interesting thing is that you refused the contract because it was stateside.
Yeah.
You were told that you were going to kill him at Bethesda Naval Hospital.
That's
because
right.
He was giving secrets to the enemy, or preparing to.
Mm-hmm.
Then years later, you came across Lieutenant Commander Pitzer's name in an entirely different context, and you learned what you believe to be the real reason for this contract. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. On the 30th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, I was watching a special, a two-hour special, I think it was and Jack Anderson. And at the end of the special, they rolled these names of 42 people, I believe it was, who had died a violent death that were somehow, one way or another, connected with the assassination, the autopsy, or the cover-up. And the name William Bruce Pitcher came down. And I about got sick right there in my own living room. And I contacted a professor friend of mine who was active in this assassination thing, because there was the name of the man that I'd been asked to kill back in 1965. And there he was, a witness in the Kennedy assassination. So I asked the professor to find out when he was going to a COPA conference, when he was killed and where he was killed. And he came back and he told me. And then a friend of mine named Robin Palmer went down to Washington, D.C. and found, by going through newspaper morgues, the address of the widow, Joyce Pitcher. And I called her. And that was the most difficult conversation I ever had in my life, because I had to tell her that I'm the man that was asked to kill her husband. But I wanted to talk to her because I wanted to let her know that it was probably the CIA that arranged for it.
Now, specifically, Commander Pitzer was involved with the autopsy at Bethesda Naval Hospital that we were alluding to earlier in connection with Pierre Fink. Could you tell us about Commander Pitzer's role in the autopsy?
Yes, he was in charge of the television operation. He was responsible for recording the autopsies. And he had actually recorded the entire autopsy, but his film was never shown. There is a man named Dennis David, who now lives in Illinois, retired like myself, but a Navy officer who was his very close friend and who has, with William Bruce Pitzer, reviewed those films and slides of the autopsy. And this has also been shown at least six times since November of 1995 in the Nigel Turner documentary, The Men Who Killed Kennedy, The Truth Shall Make You Free, which has been aired that many times, six times on the History Channel at least. And yet, again, the ARRB and the AARC are not interested. These organizations that are supposed to be putting all this stuff together so we can solve this puzzle, not interested in his testimony either, not deposed him.
It's the JFK assassination community is not only infiltrated but highly fractious, and it's one of the obstacles that seekers of truth have to contend with. And this is not necessarily to point the finger at any one individual under the circumstances. Now, with regard to,
I'd be glad to.
Well, that if we open up that can of worms, we're going to take up the whole rest of our time here, because it's a long story, and I've had my share of researcher wars too in the same context.
Oh no, I'm not talking about that.
Yeah,
do know this, and Mrs. Pitts was not allowed to have the autopsy of her own husband for 25 years. I know that Mrs. Pitzer told me personally, and I recorded the conversation, that she was approached by four naval intelligence personnel the day after her husband died and told to never talk to anybody about it, not even family. I know that when she finally got the autopsy in 1991, that she was told not to show it to anybody else. And as late as 6 months ago, she was instructed personally by the man who runs, the president of the ARC, not to even release it to her nephew.
And the now, with regard to Commander Pitzer, and again, that's worth noting without mentioning any names, but this was somebody who was within the research community. Now, Commander Pitzer had been instructed, according to the account in the Fourth Decades issue of May of 1995, to destroy the information that he had filmed, and yet he would not.
That's right. And his widow told me that she had no doubt that that's why he was killed, because they didn't want that information to go public, and he would not give it to them.
With regard to the actual cause of death, what was the official version?
It was a gunshot wound to the right temple, and it was listed as suicide. Very incomplete investigation. And I've reported all the incompleteness of it to Congressman Hinchey, who's done absolutely nothing with it, and the ARRB and the AARC. Dennis David claims that he played bridge many, many times with Pitcher, and that Pitcher, his close friend, was left-handed.
And so the gunshot wound does not make sense in those in that context.
Now, Mrs. Pitcher does say herself, that, and she's told me this personally because I asked her, and it's recorded. I've got a record of it, which has also been provided to these people, that her husband was right-handed. Now, whether or not she's saying that because she was told to, I don't know. Intimidation goes a long way. She is so afraid of losing her pension, mind you. A widow that's been threatened with a loss of her pension if she talks about her own husband's murder.
She's 80 years old now.
80-some years old, yeah.
Certainly that's something that could be very intimidating to someone in those circumstances.
Well, you'd think Congress would be interested in looking into it, if only for the sake of getting the truth to an 80-year-old widow. Of a naval hero.
Unfortunately, part of the legacy of President Kennedy's assassination, and one of the reasons why I think it's very important that this investigation go forward for all of the divisions within the research community, the legacy of having our top political leaders murdered with impunity by rogue elements of our national security establishment, and in my opinion in combination with international fascist elements as well, is that basically now...
I don't think it was rogue elements. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I do not think it was rogue elements.
Well, when I say rogue, I mean in terms of the Constitution. No, it was basically a coup d'etat. They were not operating outside of context. But in other words, they were not behaving the way Americans are supposed to behave.
Amen.
No, but no, I don't think that these were people acting on their own at all. I think the orders came down from the highest echelons of the national security establishment.
Amen.
The legacy of that being, as the old saying has it, that it can be truly said that treason doth never succeed, because when it succeeds, none dare call it treason.
Amen.
And now we have a political legacy in which political assassination, coups d'etat, can be accomplished with impunity, and yet even those who know and even those who disagree with it, many of them are afraid to speak up.
That's
because
right.
They know the consequences of such disobedience.
Amen.
Now, one of the curious things concerning Commander Pitzer was that you were told, of course, that he was a traitor, conspiring to give secrets to the enemy, and yet he held a top security clearance for a long time after that period.
I know he had at least a secret under a national agency check, which is your most thorough check. I've got a copy of that.
And again, he was filming President Kennedy's autopsy, and students of President Kennedy's assassination know that the official version is nonsense, and that basically the wounds would have revealed that it was not a lone nut doing
Dennis,
it.
Dennis David will tell you. He saw him. He saw the film. He saw the slides that showed the entry wound in the temple and half of the skull missing in the back. But unfortunately, not the right people don't want to hear it. They don't want to see it. They don't even want tapes. They just want to continue the cover-up.
Now, we're almost at the end of this half-hour segment of our interview. President Kennedy's assassination had a profound effect on this country's history, and it also had a profound effect on this country's military history. President Kennedy had not intended to put main force battle units in Vietnam, and in fact was looking at a phased withdrawal of U.S. forces to Vietnamize the war. As students of the assassination history know, and John Newman's recent book, JFK in Vietnam, underscored that, President Kennedy's assassination then opened up the way for our involvement in Vietnam. And it's a tragic legacy which is with us to this day. And what we're going to do in the next half hour of our interview is we're going to examine your career or your posting to Vietnam and some of the things that you were involved in there. And it would seem, Dan, that your unwillingness to perform skullduggery and to violate the Constitution, basically, once again, and this is to your credit, bedeviled you in your posting in Vietnam. We're going to talk about the story of the Basak Bastards in the next side of our interview. This is Dave Emery. We've been speaking with Colonel Dan Marvin. Thanks for listening.